Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, Robert Knott is going to be with us speaking of the arts. Right now, I am delighted to welcome Bruce Robertson. He is a professor of art history at the University of California at Santa Barbara, and he is co-curator of the new exhibit that's opening today at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum. It's called Georgia O'Keeffe Abstraction. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good morning.
It's great to have you here. Now, Georgia O'Keeffe, very famous artist in the Southwest, very famous artist all over the world, known for her paintings of the Southwest, probably above all, although there's far more that she's done. Let's talk for a moment about this whole idea of Georgia O'Keeffe's abstraction. What is the importance of the movement in the early 20th century of abstraction? Why is that important to us?
Well, because it really changes everything. It's and it's not just O'Keeffe. What's interesting is that all of these artists, right around the same day, right around 1910, 1915, they all start moving towards abstraction, and they all do it individually. And the thing about O'Keeffe is she comes on her abstraction in her own way like no one else. And it's there underneath everything she does. So the point of this exhibition is so that you start seeing her Southwest landscapes differently. And you realize the kind of language that's underneath them, the visual language, and the very, very personal abstract language.
What was happening that created the conditions whereby so many people started painting in an abstract manner?
You know, every historian argues and debates that. And, you know, I don't know. It's almost as though there comes a kind of tipping point or point of collapse, as though everything that had happened in Europe had just gone far enough. And of course, the dark side of that is World War I. And it's not a mistake that the two of them happen virtually simultaneously, where World War I changes the map of Europe and changes the relationship of America to the rest of the world fundamentally. And in a sense, abstraction is the kind of bright, you know, positive version of that change. Why both happen? Who knows?
Right. Well, I mean, one could imagine that when you're looking at a horror that you don't want to look at, you stop painting in a representational manner.
Right. But what's interesting, and this, I was just saying this to Barbara Lines, who's the curator at the O'Keeffe Museum last night, the poet Shelley says that artists are the mirrors of futurity, and in this, they get to abstraction before World War I happens, because abstraction happens in 1910, so 4 or 5 years before the war. So artists anticipate, and that's actually one of the things that, you know, that's why we look at art.
Right, and it is an interesting and probably somewhat inexplicable phenomenon that art does kind of tell the future. There are people who make the argument that it even tells the kind of precedes scientific movements.
Yeah, yeah. So in a sense, you know, you have in science, you have someone like Freud trying to investigate the unconscious. You have Einstein investigating structures of the universe which nobody had thought of. And simultaneously, you have artists investigating abstraction, because they're not... Abstraction isn't a style. It's a state of mind. And it's a way to say things that hadn't been said before about what's inside a person. And that's really what O'Keeffe is after.
The boundary, particularly in somebody like O'Keeffe, but you could probably make this argument for a lot of people, between abstract and representational art is a little bit hard to draw, because if you look at something closely enough, it becomes an abstraction.
Right, exactly. And she says herself, nothing is less real than realism. You know, she's perfectly aware that everything is constructed. And what's really great about the show, we've included a few things that are, you know, technically representational, a few flowers, a few things like that. And when you look at the paintings, you realize that the abstraction, you start seeing the ways in which they are fundamentally abstract, that the language and the abstraction hanging next to it, because the way the show's hung, you have an abstraction next to a representational work, and you realize that they're the same thing.
Right. Well, and also, I mean, for me, having studied art history and looking at compositions, compositions all have an abstract base. The figures are moving around in the shape of a triangle and so on.
Right, exactly. And, you know, and you experience the world by editing it. And, you know, it's a question, how far are you going to edit it? And which direction are you going to edit it? And O'Keefe, she starts in 1915, and it's an amazing primal moment in American art. She sits on the floor of her bedroom where she's teaching in South Carolina, and she tosses everything out the window, all of her technical skills. She was a very accomplished artist. They all go out the window, and she simply sits on the floor and starts drawing these very simple drawings in charcoal, abstract patterns, and that's how she recreates herself as an artist.
We're talking to Bruce Robertson, co-curator of the Georgia O'Keeffe Abstraction Exhibit. I was reading the catalog essays last night, and one of them said that at a certain point, O'Keeffe, when she was young, looked at her work and said, "My God, my work looks just like every other art student's work."
Yeah. Yeah, and she's actually in the very first generation of American artists who are really professionally trained. So she went to university. You know, there's very, very few American artists who've gone to university at that point. She has the best training that you could possibly get. And then she realizes that if she's going to be an artist, she has to get rid of it all. And she'd actually trained herself to be a teacher. She thought she was going to be a teacher, that, you know, a transmitter of other people's work. And then she realized that she wanted to be an artist. And that's a very different state of mind. And in order to be an artist, she had to assert her ability to say what she felt. And she did it through abstraction first.
That is it. Talk for a moment about that phenomenon of this first generation of professionally trained artists. What was happening?
Well, it's part of the whole professionalization of American life. You know, the AMA gets founded around this time, you know, and lawyers organize and all of that. But it's also because, in a sense, the world gets so complicated, and you need to be trained in order to deal with it. And it's the same for artists as for anybody else. And they're just beginning to be careers for artists. I mean, being an artist in the United States in the 19th century was a very, very difficult proposition. And women are beginning to enter professions, and the way women are generally trained to be teachers. And it's just this complicated moment when people are trying to figure out how are they going to make art a big, sustained thing in American culture. And one way you do that is you get trained, you give yourself credentials.
So when one talks about abstraction, that's kind of a big category into which a lot of things get thrown. And one thing that is in that category is this very hard-edged industrial, and in that moment, I remember when I was a student studying the Russian constructivists and all these people who believed in the power and the kind of redemptive and liberating power of technology.
Right.
That's one thing, and so they made all these hard-edged forms. And then you've got Georgia O'Keeffe, who was really coming from nature.
Right, right.
Totally different basis.
Right, and it's very interesting. The European abstraction painters who are hard-edged like that are living in cultures which are not terribly technological. You know, Moscow in 1917 is not an advanced industrial economy. American artists are living in the most advanced industrial economy in the world, and they reject that technology. They already understand that technology is not going to be
our savior,
because they're living in it, and they know that they are the same human beings as anybody else. Technology hasn't changed them, and virtually every American abstract artist, without exception, heads towards nature. And the one who doesn't, Man Ray, goes to Europe.
Very interesting. Well, and that's the flip side of that. People whose lives are encumbered by technology then romanticize nature.
Right, exactly. But, I mean, O'Keeffe, what is so interesting about O'Keeffe is she doesn't romanticize anything. You know, in a sense, her personality is pretty hard-edged.
Right.
And so she literally goes into nature to find what she needs. There's these great things, these very early abstractions. You can sense that she's looking at water, that she is looking at a fountain, that she's looking at seeds, you know, and she's projecting the whole technological world. It's a very conscious and sort of unromantic decision, partly because it really is you know, people sort of talk about O'Keeffe as this very sensual person. I don't think she actually was, but she's fully aware of her body, and it's that body connection to the world around it, which a machine interrupts.
Right. Well, there's always, I mean, when you have an artist like O'Keeffe, okay, she's influenced by the art world around her and the time in which she grew up, and then the nature that she's looking at, but then there's also something that just comes from within, a kind of introspection, and even a kind of, there's one painting that I remember seeing who's had the word music in its title, so it's almost like a kind of synesthesia where you're hearing things and translating through your own, what, heart.
Absolutely. She loves music. She actually, it's really funny, at the very moment at which she invents these first abstractions, she's actually trying to learn the violin. I mean, and I can't imagine O'Keeffe as a violinist somehow. It just, it's not an image that you think of, but she's practicing for hours.
Wow.
And she actually had a big record collection. You know, you go to her studio and there are the LPs, you know, miles of them. She loved music. And it's there in the paintings. And as did Stieglitz.
And so when you, knowing all these things, that brings something for the viewers who are, you know, here it is, Sunday morning, let's go to the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum, and you start to see things in a new way, which is also, as you mentioned, really helped by the way the show is hung.
This is the third venue.
It was at the Whitney Museum.
Yes, it was at the Whitney Museum, which is this big modernist building with big, big spaces. I didn't see it at the Phillips Collection, which is a nice domestic-scaled interior, which is, these paintings are domestic. They're not intended for museums until the very late ones. And you see at the very late paintings that she's competing with people like Ellsworth Kelly and the others. You know, she's out there.
Let's make big paintings.
Let's make big paintings. Because O'Keeffe is always competitive, you know, and she's never unobservant about what's going on. But what the O'Keeffe Museum installation does is it's intimately scaled. The ceilings are low. The paintings are perfect for that environment. And what's interesting is that they were all painted, most of them, before she got to New Mexico. So somehow, you know, there's this real inner harmony there. And because the rooms are small scale, the paintings sing to each other in a way that they didn't, or they weren't able to at the Whitney. And Barbara Lines has really hung it with this kind of free authority, because she knows the material so well. So she mixes up the chronology a lot. And you know, you don't have to pay attention as a visitor to the dates on the paintings at all, but you have to pay attention to the juxtapositions, because all of the juxtapositions are very, very canny, and they bring out things like in all of these monochrome white paintings, and white was her color. These white paintings, they're hung so that you actually see the colors which are inside the whiteness, and they're just this beautiful installation.
Very interesting. These paintings were painted, as you said, mostly before Georgia O'Keeffe came to New Mexico. She spent many years of her life here in New Mexico. How did New Mexico affect her painting in terms of abstraction? Did she stop painting abstractly here?
You know, abstraction was tied to her most intimate feelings, and those became bound up with Stieglitz, and Stieglitz betrays her. And in 1930, she realizes the depth of his betrayal. In 1932, she has a breakdown. She doesn't paint for 2 years, and she makes no art. And it's at that point she realizes that if she's going to have a life, she has to live in New Mexico full time. But it's also, in a sense, she had put her personal self through her abstraction out for the world to see, and she couldn't do it anymore. So she comes to New Mexico, and it's about a 10-year period where she does no abstraction whatsoever. She rebuilds herself as an artist fundamentally. She rebuilds herself on the landscape of New Mexico, and it's through the landscape that she returns to abstraction. So there's this beautiful moment in the show right at the end where there's one last room which just floats, and it's New Mexico scenes and scenes of clouds above the... She's flying above the clouds in the sky. And it's just... you realize that New Mexico enables her to find herself again as an artist at a moment where she literally couldn't paint because she couldn't talk.
We're talking to Bruce Robertson about the Georgia O'Keeffe Abstraction Exhibit, which opens today at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum. It is really interesting to contemplate for us non-artists or non-curators what it means that your most intimate and personal feelings can be revealed through something which is non-representational.
Yeah, it's interesting because you want to keep finding specific references in these paintings. You want to look at them and say, oh, that's what this represents, or that's what prompts this painting. And sometimes you can. Sometimes you know it's she's actually looking at a fountain in a courtyard, and this is what she's abstracting. But most of the time you can't. And she's perfectly okay with that, because she knows that her language is speaking to you at a bodily level below the conscious. And that's the level that she's communicating. That's where she places her abstraction. And she uses color as well. It's not just forms. She uses colors that are so intense, as you know, Beth Turner, one of the other co-curators, said that, you know, she saw a purple petunia in a painting by O'Keeffe, and it imprinted itself on her brain at a visceral level. And so that's the language that she's speaking.
Right, and what's interesting is that then later that intimate self is found in another kind of nature out there. I mean, it sort of seems like the extension of one's own inner self suddenly can, or gradually, is found in a much larger space.
Right, but you can see how powerfully she reads that landscape and speaks that landscape because of the effect of all of these people who want to come to Santa Fe to experience for real the landscape that she has spoken to them, or the nature she has spoken to them, or the language that they've heard in those paintings.
Right.
I mean, that's how you know you've got an artist who really is speaking to you clearly. You might not understand the words, but you're hearing and understanding at a level below consciousness or above consciousness.
One thing that is, it's a kind of funny thing, being an art historian and basically working with the same bodies of work and the same documents generation after generation, mm-hmm. and exploring and re-exploring a particular artist, in this case Georgia O'Keeffe. What have you learned through the process of doing this? How are we seeing her freshly through this exhibition?
Well, freshly in a lot of ways. One is that it does kind of cleanse your palate of the overexposure that O'Keeffe tends to suffer from, so that you actually can now see her freshly, and you can see the flowers freshly, and you can see the landscapes freshly. So that, I think, is a really major accomplishment. The other is that you understand that O'Keeffe belongs to the first generation of abstract artists. She's there with Kandinsky, you know, right there at the beginning. She's only a few years past Kandinsky.
Interesting.
She's also the artist who remains an abstract artist the longest of any of them. So there she is in the teens, inventing abstraction along with all the others. There she is in the 70s, still painting abstraction, where all of that first generation is gone. And so you start seeing O'Keeffe as this great survivor figure. And for me, my interest in abstraction, O'Keeffe's abstraction, became when I walked into a private collection, and there was this great black and white abstraction from 1930 on one side, and it was gray and black, and on the other side was a Jasper Johns from 1957, one of the gray paintings. And I looked at the two of them and I thought, what would happen if you told the history of American 20th century art with O'Keeffe at the center of it, leading to Jasper Johns?
Very, very interesting. So this opens today, this afternoon, and it's been at these three venues. What else do you think that we should know about Georgia O'Keeffe?
Good question. I mean, in one sense, it's very funny. In one sense, we know too much about her, and you keep wanting to read her paintings biographically.
Right.
One of the things I wanted to do was to get people to look very, very consciously at the size of her paintings and the ratios of height to width, because O'Keeffe is an artist who always changes the size of her paintings. Now, most artists, they choose a standard canvas size and they just go at it. And you walk into an exhibition by an artist, and they're all the same size on the wall. And O'Keeffe, they're never the same size. And what that tells you is that every time she picks up a canvas to paint the next in a sequence or to look at a motif again, she picks up a different canvas, and she has to rethink everything, because she's always working with the frame and the ratio of the motif to the frame and size and that kind of thing. So one of the things that I would love people to look at in the exhibition is just to step back a second and think about just the sizes and the scale and the ratio of these paintings. There's a whole sequence of little white paintings, little tall, narrow white paintings, done one a year in the 20s. Every one of them looks similar until you realize that they're all different sizes. Subtly, they're an inch narrower, 2 inches taller, and what it tells you is she's an artist who could never make herself do the same thing.
That's so interesting, because a lot of people in whatever their profession, art or anything else, go into a comfort zone and into a pattern and stay there.
Right.
She did the opposite.
She did the opposite. And, you know, she does series. And we know her that she does a motif and she does a series, 6 or 7 paintings on the same subject. We've got one of them complete, the Jack in the Pulpit series, which is this great series from the early 30s. Of the 6 paintings in the series, 3 are the same size and the other 3 are radically different. And you look at them in the room and you think, okay, Monet's Haystacks, all the same size. Monet's Rouen Cathedral, all the same size. Or an artist like Agnes Martin, you know, all the same size. O'Keeffe, absolutely not.
Very interesting. Bruce Robertson is professor of art history at the University of California at Santa Barbara. He's co-curator of the Georgia O'Keeffe Abstraction Exhibition, which opens at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum. This afternoon at 5:00?
I think it's open all today.
They
were letting the people in yesterday because they figured it was done. Why not let the public in?
Well, we are so looking forward to seeing it. I can't wait. My friends in New York were telling me about it when it was at the Whitney, and this is, as you say, perhaps even a more interesting hanging of the show.
Yeah, I think it's what I said to you earlier, it's a juicier hanging. These paintings really, I've worked with this material now for 4 years. They look new and fresh to me here.
Well, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
We're going to take a break right now, and Rob DeWald will be here sitting in for Robert Knott. Please stay tuned. I'd like now to welcome Rob DeWald. He is sitting in for Robert Knott, speaking of the arts. He is with the Pasatiempo, Friday Arts Magazine, with the Santa Fe New Mexican. Welcome.
Good morning. Yes, Robert Knott couldn't be with us today. He is actually flying in a B-17 aircraft that's out there at the Santa Fe Municipal Airport for the weekend.
It's a tough job,
it's a
but
tough
someone's got to do it.
Anybody can get on the plane and fly. It's only $450 per person. So
that's all.
Yeah.
Excellent. So Desiree Mays is also here. Hi, Desiree.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte. Bright and early.
Yeah, you were here bright and early to remind our listeners. We've made a promo, but our opera series starts on Monday.
Yes, it does. We've done the homework, and the shows are in the can, as they say. So we are talking about one opera of the Santa Fe Opera every week, every Monday. And
for the next 5 weeks,
this Monday. The kickoff is the Tales of Hoffmann, which is the marvelous piece by Jacques Offenbach.
Right.
We're actually going to play lots of music. So for those people out there in radio listening land, you're going to get a lot of music with Mary Charlotte and me.
It's a lot of music. I mean, it's almost half and half music. No, we talk a little bit more than...
I think we do, but it gives you a real... if we're talking about opera, we have to play opera, right? It's a little hard just to talk about it. And then hopefully people will trot up the hill to the Santa Fe Opera to hear the whole thing when
yes.
the season starts on July 2nd.
Now, let me ask you a question. I don't know if this is something that you know, but a few friends of mine have said it's just too expensive. Are there inexpensive tickets for the opera?
Yes, of course there are. I mean, I compare this to going to a ball game. You actually pay far more if you go to a ball game these days.
Uh-huh.
And if you go and buy Coke and popcorn and a T-shirt and all the bits that go with it, as most people do, my kids buy CDs and things when they go to these big rock concerts. They pay far more money than I do going to the opera. Now, if you're going to sit in the fifth row, yes, you're going to pay a lot of money, probably.
Right.
But there are a lot of good seats with great viewing, even right down on the main floor, and you just have to pick up that phone and call now because they do go fast and there are still tickets. Certainly once you get into the season, July is a good time because to go to the opera, because we bring up, as we say, one opera each week.
Right.
There's a rehearsal. We can't do all five at once because logistically that's just impossible. So that's a good time to go because the hordes have not descended. But come at the beginning of August when we run five operas simultaneously, that's when all the outsiders, the rest of the world descends.
Comes so in, yeah, because you can, in August, you can come on Saturday, on Sunday, and then go to five operas in a row and see all five operas and then go home at the end of 1 week.
That's right. The group I work with, Act One Tours, we're bringing in three groups this year and they will see five operas. They come in on a Sunday, have a welcome dinner, go to five operas and go home at the weekend. So that sort of immersion. But for people here, I think, who want to see these operas, yeah, go in July early or in later in August. And the advantage of August, of course, is that the curtain is not at 9 o'clock. It's first of all at 8:30, and then the very last week is at 8 o'clock. That's because the sun goes down earlier and it gets cool.
That's right. We're in touch with the cycles of nature.
Absolutely. Opera and nature go hand in hand. And we have to wait for Mother Nature and the sun to set to be able to light the shows.
Desiree Mays is the author of Opera Unveiled. It's the book that accompanies the Santa Fe opera season every year. One chapter about one of each of the five operas. And 12th printing. This is your 12th year doing this.
It's exciting. It's the five operas a year, and we talk about those in depth, tell stories, anecdotes, you know, all the fun things. It's and it's a quick read. You know, it's a short chapter.
It is
indeed. You're on an airplane, read it, and it's done. And then you're ready for the opera. So.
Now, speaking of fun things, Rob DeWalt is with us here speaking of the arts.
There's all kinds of fun things going on. Speaking of fun things and opera, the backstage tours are starting on Monday the 31st. They run, I believe, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. And then Saturday is an opera insider day. Saturday, I think at 8:30, the tours start at 9 o'clock.
In the morning?
Monday, yes. Yeah,
that's a good time to go before it gets too hot.
Yeah, that's early.
Right, right. They're very inexpensive. Under 17, there's no charge. The insider days on Saturday are actually no charge. And they include talks by certain people, I believe. The first one is next Saturday is
the prop director. Randy Lutz. Right. Do go to him. He's mm-hmm. wonderful. So yeah. You go up at 8:30, you get coffee and muffins.
Yes.
And then one of the department heads will speak about production. And that gives you an insight that's absolutely fascinating. And they're all great speakers.
Yeah, I plan on going to a couple of them this year. Mm-hmm. The production, the prop designer especially.
And that's on SantaFeOpera.org. I think they have the listing of who's speaking which Saturdays. So
yes,
you can go many Saturdays.
There's 13 Saturdays throughout the season that they're doing.
And then you can go to the flea market, right?
Yes, exactly.
Exactly. Now, I'm not going to be here next week. We will resume the week after. But so I'm going to make some announcements of things that are coming up a little later. On Sunday, the 6th of June from 2 to 5, Cocktails for Critters, Felines and Friends is inviting you to enjoy fine wine and food while bidding on fabulous gift certificates and special items at a luxury Santa Fe estate. You can get in touch with Felines and Friends by just Googling Felines and Friends New Mexico and Cocktails for Critters the 6th of June.
Great. There's a lot of openings this weekend. One I'm really interested in is the one at Santa Fe Clay on today, 5 to 7 p.m. There's a reception. It's called Decalcomania. National Invitational Group Show. There's a reception tonight from 5 to 7. That shows up through June 26th, though. Of course, the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum, the show opens.
Yes, we just talked about that in some
today.
Detail.
Yes, and that's there's a great story in today's Pasatiempo by Mr. Douglas Fairfield on the show.
Not to mention front page news on the regular daily paper.
Yes, I know. That's
good stuff.
Took me by surprise. But tonight is the Delgado Street 4th Friday Art Walk on Canyon Road and Delgado Streets. It's a self-guided gallery tour from 5 to 8 p.m. You can go to discoverdelgado.com to get more information on that.
Excellent.
Big screen classics tonight. The Birds.
The Birds at the Lenzic, Alfred Hitchcock.
Exactly. If anyone saw the film Birdemic that was in town recently, Birdemic Shock and Terror.
Yeah, I remember.
If you
want
to sort of erase that, scrub that off your brain pan, go and see this show. And actually on Saturday they're showing Vertigo.
That is a great movie.
Yeah, it's one
was
of my favorite.
Was it Kim Novak and Jimmy Stewart?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The Birds was the first Hitchcock that I ever saw. My dad made me watch it, and I I'm scared to death whenever I see more than four birds.
I know.
I actually
decided when I was a kid not to see it because some my friends started getting scared of all, you know, canaries and stuff.
Well, we had a parakeet. I said we can only have one bird at a time because more than that, there's going to be a massacre.
Exactly.
It's all about Meowwolf this weekend. There's a lot of Meowwolf related stuff going on.
Meowwolf is a collective of young artists who are fantastic.
Yes, and tonight they are having an opening reception. There's going to be paintings and an installation by Katie Kennedy and drawings by Ariel Aminoff. And there's a reception from 5 to 9. That show is only up through tomorrow. But Meowwolf is also having a benefit art auction. It's a community event at Back Row Pizza on Saturday from 8 to 10 p.m.
Excellent.
That's over there on 2nd Street. And then also... Meowwolf is having a, it's called Super Power Dance Destroyer. It's a
is
dance party.
Is that a robot or an event?
And if I can find it on my little thing here. Anyway, I'll find it. There's a lot of Meowwolf stuff going on, so just pick up the Pasta Tiempo and look for all the things that are happening with Meowwolf because it's a great collective. They're doing really great work.
Most excellent. Okay, and let's see. Another thing that's happening, I was just looking for the Meow Wolf, but I couldn't find it either. The Joan Duffy chapter, the Santa Fe chapter of Veterans for Peace is showing Arlington West this Sunday, the 30th of May, at 7 o'clock at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation on the corner of Galistea and Barcelona. Donations are accepted, but it's a free event. And we had them on the air a few days ago just talking about that film, which sounds pretty interesting.
Yes, I found it. Tonight at the Veterans of Foreign Wars, Meowwolf is hosting Superpower Dance Destroyer with DJs Neegs, Dirt Girl, and Snarls. It's at 9 p.m. There's a small cover. I mean, look at it this way: it's at the VFW. First of all, second of all, it's a 21 and over gig. They sell alcohol there, and it's the only place in Santa Fe that you can still legally smoke. I guess.
Is that right?
Yeah. If you're into that sort of thing.
A friend of mine belongs to a smoking club, a private smoking club.
Is it a cigar club or
a cigar club? Yeah.
Yes.
And so that's another place.
I'm sure there's much more going on than just smoking. I'm sure there's
drinking.
I'm sure there's philosophical conversations and all kinds of things going on.
Now, the artist Carol Anthony, whom we talked to also on the show the other day, is having a show that opens today. There's not an opening reception, but it is going on for, I think, about a month. It's called... it's going on through the 3rd of July, called Private Glimpses. And Carol Anthony is an amazing... magical artist, mm-hmm. And so her paintings will be exhibited at the Gerald Peters Gallery.
What else is going on? There's Corazon is having a similarly titled event on Saturday called Super Funky Psychedelic Pussycat Swingers Ball. Say that 10 times fast.
With
DJs Maynard Del Mar, Mute Swan, and The Infector, and Aaron E. and Dirt Girl. That's at 9 p.m. on Saturday. If you put on a costume and you get there before 11 p.m., there's no cover. So, you know.
You know.
Frog Fest 5 is this weekend. 15 bands in 12 hours. It's like an Americana marathon. A marathon. highlights include 100 Year Flood, Joe West, Goshen, The Strange. This year they're adding something a little different. That's the Blues Punkers, Angola Farms. Noon to midnight, Santa Fe Brewing Company. Call 424-3333 for more information on that.
And I got a notice from the Edge Gallery that they're having an opening today from 6 until 9 on Canyon Road, presenting Mark Catano and Nicole Catano. And don't know that much about their work, but you can check it out. It's that gallery that's on the corner of Paseo and Canyon Road. For more information, 992-0333.
Yeah. William Powers on Tuesday the 1st is going to discuss and sign copies of 12 by 12, A One Room Cabin Off the Grid and Beyond the American Dream at 5 p.m. at Garcia Street Books.
I read that book.
Did you like it?
From cover to cover. It's very, very good. We're going to do an interview next week, I think on the day of the, yeah, on Tuesday.
Yeah.
It's a really thoughtful and interesting book. This is a guy who met a woman who decided to live off the grid in a house that was 12 by 12 because if it's that small, you don't pay taxes and you don't have to conform to the building code because they consider it a shed. And so he lived in this place that had basically 2 acres of permaculture farm around him. And it was like a life-changing contemplative experience, but it wasn't a retreat from all things bad because they were surrounded by these like really ugly factory chickens farms that were all smelly and things like that. Ooh. Very, very interesting book.
I'm going to have to do, well, if you have it, I'll borrow it.
I have it.
Also on Tuesday the 1st, Fayuca, a ska punk band, a ska punk and reggae band, and Eyes of Nine, which is this sort of crossover rock hip-hop collective, are playing at 9 p.m. The Underground, which is inside Evangelo's downstairs. This is great. I wrote about this in my column today. The New Mexico Symphony Orchestra, the Duke City Sound Barbershop Chorus, and others are doing a tribute to Queen and Freddie Mercury. It's called We Will Rock You, a tribute to Queen. And it's tonight. It's in Albuquerque, but you know what? It's Memorial Day weekend. Everyone's taking a road trip. Go up to Albuquerque. It's at Sandia Resort and Casino Amphitheater. It's a great space. I saw Judas Priest there last year. That's 8 p.m. Friday. If you go to nmso.org or call, just go to nmso.org and find information on tickets. It's going to be a lot of fun.
And at Collected Works Bookstore on Thursday, the 3rd of June, Frederick Turner, The Go-Between, a novel of the Kennedy years. Do you know anything about that book?
I don't. I hope it's not another conspiracy book. I hope.
It's a novel, so who knows?
All right.
It's supposed to be good. He's supposed to be great. And then on Monday, the 7th of June, Brady Udall, The Lonely Polygamist. Now, I was going to try to schedule that. I'm not sure I'm going to make it because schedule's kind of packed, but
Dorothy's.
Oh, you did?
Yep.
Okay, tell us.
Tell us. Well, if I told you, then you wouldn't read the story in the Pasatiempo next week, would you? No. He's a great guy. He actually has ties to the New Mexico Udall family. His, Brady's great-grandfather, I think, founded the town in Arizona where all the Udalls sort of cluster.
Okay.
And Brady's great-grandparents were polygamists. And I believe Stuart Udall is Grady's grandfather's cousin. So, yeah, it already gets a little tricky.
Okay, but tell us about, what do you think about the book?
I love the book.
Really?
I love the book. I think it's you know, a lot of people see the cover, and some of them like might even read the jacket and go, oh, this is just going to be another book about, you know, the sick side of you know, plural marriage and you know little children, you know, being, you know, molested and all these wives living in this one place, and it's actually not. It takes place in the 70s, and he steers very purposefully clear of all of the sort of, you know, all of the stuff that happens these days. You know, it's all in the news. It's basically a story of an American family. It's just that this American family happens to have 28 kids and 4 wives. You know. And it's very humorous. There's a child character in the book named Rusty that Brady said is kind of formed after his own childhood growing up. You know, he had 8 siblings of his own. So he was used to growing up in a big family, and he drew a lot on that to plan his characters. The whole book came from an Esquire article that he wrote in 1998, and he did a lot of research and actually embedded himself, well, not embedded himself, but he got in with the polygamous community and earned their trust and got a lot of really great background information so that he could write the book. And it's a fantastic, it's long. It's like 600 pages.
Is it good fun reading if you're going away for the weekend?
It is. It is good fun reading. It really is. His first draft, he told me, was 1,400 pages.
Good heavens.
Yeah. And he pared it down to 600. Well, you know, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of family members to write about, and there's a lot of background to cover. But he said he had to pare it down. He felt like he was failing when he was, you know, for about 6 months because he was trying to just hack this book down so much. But it's a great book, and I believe the signing is, I forgot, you just said.
I did just say. So you'll have to 7th. Remember what I just said.
It's the 7th.
Okay.
At Collected Works.
Ah. So let's see. Some Santa Fe musicians, Kelvin McNeil, Michael Kopp, Mati Sato, Hiroki Takeda, Jim Kinney, and many more, are playing Western, classical Western and Far Eastern songs this Saturday, that's tomorrow, from 6:30 to 9 at the Center for Spiritual Living. For more information, you can call 577-7855. And once again, there's an acupuncturist, a doctor of oriental medicine, named Dr. Laurence Lisa Le Breton, I don't know if that's pronounced correctly, who is going to Haiti as part of the organization Acupuncturists Without Borders, and she's going in about, what, a week and a half or so, and this is a fundraiser for that.
Oh, it's a fundraiser. Okay. All right.
Yep.
Madrid is holding its World Music and Dance Festival on Sunday the 30th from noon to 7 p.m. Agalu's going to be there, Nigerian drumming, Mari
Yay,
Sato.
Yeah, they're so good.
I know, they are. Kamusha Marimba Ensemble, Masnavi Dance Collective, Sultana Dancers. It's at the Oscar Huber Memorial Ballpark on New Mexico 14. And the proceeds benefit Madrid Cultural Projects. If you call 474-0033, you can find out more about tickets. Kids under 7 are no charge, though. So.
New night spot in Santa Fe. Are your ears perking up?
Rouge Cat.
Vibes is a high-energy Caribbean-oriented music and dance party opening this Friday at the Lodge. 9 until 2 in the morning, and it's going on every Friday, mixing by DJ Avi. If you like the Mambo Room, you'll love
this. Have you been to the Rouge Cat, the new nightclub? It's right downtown on Lincoln Avenue, I think.
Huh.
It's basically the home of Trash Disco every Wednesday now. I think they have a website,
rougecat.com. Trash Disco just never dies. That's a good thing.
It's Una's been doing it forever since I was bartending years ago.
Oh, I thought you were because you were in knee pants.
No. But I haven't been to the Rouge Cat yet, but I'm hearing really good things about the space. It's centrally located. They have full liquor license. They have great DJs that rotate in and out, different theme nights. Didn't have any room to put them in Pasa because nobody sent me a press release. Hint, hint.
Yes. And when you send press releases, ladies and gentlemen, be sure not to send attachments because we don't like to open attachments.
No,
we like to just read our email. Thank you very much.
Yes.
And by the way, ladies free before 10 o'clock at Vibes. Just had to add that.
Very nice. On Wednesday, the 2nd, at Cowgirl, E. Christina Hare and Wild Frontier, sort of an alt-country act. I listened to a little bit on the computer yesterday. They're quite nice, and that's at 9 p.m. on Thursday. And there's a small cover for that.
Now, several weeks ago, we had a group on talking about the Alternatives to Violence Project. They're doing a basic workshop that starts tonight at 6 o'clock, and it continues through Sunday at the Quaker House at 1730 Camino Carlos Rey, just off Cerrillos. If you meant to sign up for it, if you've got nothing to do this weekend, give them a call, 505-466-6615, and you can register for that. And once again, 466-6615.
Sunday is the season finale of the Santa Fe Community Orchestra. They're doing music of Mahler and Franz at 2:30 p.m. at the St. Francis Auditorium.
Oliver Present. Is that right?
Yes.
He's fantastic.
And there's no charge.
You know, ladies and gentlemen, this community is so full of incredible resources like that. No charge. An amazing conductor, a very good orchestra, wonderful music, and it's free.
And it's free. And it's right downtown.
If anybody ever complains that there's nothing to do, I'm going to go put a noodle in their nose.
I know. You just pay. And it's Sunday, so you don't have to pay for parking downtown. You know? I mean, all your bases are covered with that show. Pop Gallery. On Saturday, the 3rd annual Pop Femme Sugar-Coated Strange group show. There's a reception and art raffle from 6 to 8 p.m. The exhibit is up through June, and proceeds benefit Southwest Care Center.
Nice.
And it's a really, really fun show. It's always a fun show.
So here's another thing. Adopt an Arroyo Community Work Day. People should bring work gloves, hat, and sunscreen. Is happening tomorrow, the 29th of May, from 10 to 2. Lunch is provided. And it's at the Monica Lucero Park on the corner of Avenida de las Campanas and Arroyo de los Chamisos Urban Trail. If you want to know where that is or find out more about it, you can call Kina at Earthworks Institute at 603-7188. And you can go to earthworksinstitute.org for more information.
Speaking of Arroyos, I got to get this out there. I came into work on Tuesday after a four-day quote-unquote vacation and found a two-foot-tall ceramic pig in a chef outfit.
I saw that on your Facebook.
standing on my desk, and I did some investigating and found out that Robert Knott put it there.
Of course
Robert
he
Knott
did.
Found this ceramic pig in an arroyo near the compound restaurant on Canyon Road. If anybody is missing a ceramic pig, and you can describe in a little more detail the pig to me, I'll give it up. You have until Monday. Otherwise, it's going in my ceramic pig collection, which I just think I started just now.
That's just weird.
Yeah, yeah.
Why would you think that...
Reach you. How do we reach you to own up?
You can call me down at the Pasta Tempo. You can leave a number at 986-3039, and I'll get back to you. But you have to be able to describe the pig in some detail.
Yeah, and don't look on his Facebook page, because that would be cheating.
No, I told people last night, if nobody claims it, I'm going to stuff it full of candy and dreams and fill it full of holes. So,
and
yeah.
Then put it on a string and have a blindfold on and hit it with a stick?
Yeah, no, I was just going to take it out to the shooting range, but I mean, we could do that too. But someone out there is missing a pig.
He might not be missing it. He might have abandoned it. Think about that.
Yeah.
So let's see. The Photo Eye First Wednesday Photography Salon is happening on Wednesday, the 2nd of June from 6:30 to 9. Wendy Young, Eric Cousineau, Jack Combs, and Brenda Kelly. And the Photo Eye Gallery is at 376 Garcia Street, 505-988-5152, extension 114.
Awesome. There's got to support all the youth centers in this town. Warehouse 21, 7 p.m. Saturday, May 29th. They're having a tough time over there.
Are they?
Yeah. So
everybody is.
Yeah, it's true. But, you know, go out and support your teen center here. This is a rock show on Saturday, the 29th at 7 p.m., HN88, The Balcony Scene, and Out of Gear, which features the fruit of Steve Terrell's loins.
What? So can you say more about that?
Steve Terrell's son is in the band.
Oh, okay.
So that's on Saturday at 7 o'clock at Warehouse 21 over there in the rail yard.
You know, I don't know. This might be old, this email. I'm not sure. But Santa Fe is searching for its next poet laureate. And I told them that I would make an announcement about this. The poet laureate has to make appearances at city-sponsored events and must be over 21 years of age and live in Santa Fe. Oh, shoot.
And you have to know more than dirty limericks.
I screwed up. The nominations are already due. Deadline is over. Never mind. Sorry. Fail.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, this is Monday, May 31st. It's the last day of the Taos Spring Art Celebration. I'm trying to get everybody to, like, fill up their cars with gas and get out of town so I have places to park, I guess. But the Taos Art Celebration is a fun time. They do it every year, but it ends on Monday. So go and check it out. There's ongoing gallery openings and art walks and concerts, and it's everything starts at 10 p.m. And if you want more information, you can call 575-751-8800.
Excellent. Now, what's happening at the CCA? Oh, Casino Jack. Casino Jack in the United States of Money. That is, I swear to God, that is a movie that every voter in the United States of America should be required by law to see. It's basically about Jack Abramoff and the whole crazy lobbying kerfuffle catastrophe that he and many others engendered. And it opens today, and it's a good movie. It was made by Alex Gibney, who made that great film that I think didn't it win an Oscar called Taxi to the Dark Side?
Did it win an Oscar?
He won an Oscar for something. I think it was for that one. Anyway, but it's very entertaining as well as being educational. And it's the kind of movie I think I might watch it again because there's so much in it that seeing it twice helps you understand. It's actually hard to for the people who are not deeply involved in national or state politics to understand the weird complexities of how people subvert the law and all principles of ethics and decency to get their way.
Yeah, this guy also made Enron the smartest guys in the room.
Yeah.
There's a review in today's Pasta Tiempo by our newest staff writer, Casey Sanchez. Welcome aboard, Casey.
Did they like it?
Well, they gave it 3 out of 4 chilies.
Well, I give it 5 out of 4 chilies.
Oh, ooh. Mm. Okay.
It's at the CCA Santa Fe, which has all sorts of good movies.
there's a few other films. that are opening this. Well, there's The Eclipse. There's Prince of Persia, The Sands of Time. There's a lot of films that are opening up. I really am interested in seeing The Eclipse. I'm not sure why.
You know what? It's almost time to go.
I know. And before we go, I have to wish my partner a happy 19th anniversary.
Oh, how sweet.
Yes.
Happy 19th anniversary, you guys.
I came here with ulterior motives.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. Rob DeWalt, thank you so much for being with us. And Desiree Mays, thank you for being with us, too. And you've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe, broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, and all sorts of good things. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc. It's time to go. Hasta la vista, baby. Ciao.
Bye.